Chapter 2. Support, but it served to carry him lightly and easily over what is often a period of insecurity and discouragement. It would be unjust, however, to represent his interest in Mrs. Aubyn as a matter of calculation. It was as instinctive as love, and it missed being love by just such a hairbreadth deflection from the line of beauty as had determined the curve of Mrs. Aubyn's lips. When they met as he had just published her first novel, and Glenard, who afterward had an ambitious man's impatience of distinguished women, was young enough to be dazzled by the semi-publicity it gave her. It was the kind of book that makes elderly ladies lower their voices and call each other "why dear" when they furtively discuss it, and Glenard exulted in the superior knowledge of the world that enabled him to take as a matter of course sentiments over which the university shook its head. Still more delightful was it to hear Mrs. Aubyn waken the echoes of academic drawing rooms with audacities surpassing those of her printed page. Her intellectual independence gave a touch of comradeship to their intimacy, prolonging the illusion of college friendships based on a joyous interchange of heresies. Mrs. Aubyn and Glenard represented to each other the augur's wink behind the Hillbridge idol. They walked together in that light of young omniscience from which fate so curiously excludes one's elders. Husbands who are notoriously inopportune may even die inopportunely, and this was the revenge that Mr. Aubyn, some 2 years after her return to Hillbridge, took upon his injured wife. He died precisely at the moment when Glenard was beginning to criticize her. It was not that she bored him. She did what was infinitely worse. She made him feel his inferiority. The sense of mental equality had been gratifying to his raw ambition, but as his self-knowledge defined itself, his understanding of her also increased. And if man is at times indirectly flattered by the moral superiority of woman, her mental ascendancy is extenuated by no such oblique tribute to his powers. The attitude of looking up is a strain on the muscles, and it was becoming more and more Glenard's opinion that brains, in a woman, should be merely the obverse of beauty. To beauty Mrs. Aubyn could lay no claim, and while less he had enough prettiness to exasperate him by her incapacity to make use of it, she seemed invincibly ignorant of any of the little artifices whereby women contrive to palliate their defects, and even to turn them into graces. Her dress never seemed a part of her. All her clothes had an impersonal air, as though they had belonged to someone else, and been borrowed in an emergency that had somehow become chronic. She was conscious enough of her deficiencies to try to amend them by rash imitations of the most approved models, but no woman who does not dress well intuitively will ever do so by the light of reason, and Mrs. Aubyn's plagiarisms, to borrow a metaphor of her trade, somehow never seemed to be incorporated with the text. Genius is of small use to a woman who does not know how to do her hair. The fame that came to Mrs. Aubyn with her second book left Glenard's imagination untouched, or had at most the negative effect of removing her still farther from the circle of his contracting sympathies. We are all the sport of time, and fate had so perversely ordered the chronology of Margaret Aubyn's romance that when her husband died Glenard felt as though he had lost a friend. It was not in his nature to be needlessly unkind, and though he was in the impregnable position of the man who has given a woman no more definable claim on him than that of letting her fancy that he loves her, he would not for the world have accentuated his advantage by any betrayal of indifference. During the first year of her widowhood their friendship dragged on with halting renewals of sentiment, becoming more and more a banquet of empty dishes from which the covers were never removed. Then Glenard went to New York to live and exchanged the faded pleasures of intercourse for the comparative novelty of correspondence. Her letters, oddly enough, seemed at first to bring her nearer than her presence. As he had adopted, and she successfully maintained, a note as affectionately impersonal as his own. She wrote ardently of her work, she questioned him about his, she even bantered him on the inevitable pretty girl who was certain before long to divert the current of his confidences. To Glenard, who was almost a stranger in New York. The sight of Mrs. Aubin's writing was like a voice of reassurance in surroundings as yet insufficiently aware of him. His vanity found a retrospective enjoyment in the sentiment his heart had rejected, and this factitious emotion drove him once or twice to Hillbridge, whence, after scenes of evasive tenderness, he returned dissatisfied with himself and her. As he made room for himself in New York, and peopled the space he had cleared with the sympathies at the disposal of agreeable and self-confident young men, it seemed to him natural to infer that Mrs. Aubin had refurnished in the same manner the void he was not unwilling his departure should have left. But in the dissolution of sentimental partnerships it is seldom that both associates are able to withdraw their funds at the same time. And Glenard gradually learned that he stood for the venture on which Mrs. Aubin had irretrievably staked her all. It was not the kind of figure he cared to cut. He had no fancy for leaving havoc in his wake, and would have preferred to sow a quick growth of oblivion in the spaces wasted by his unconsidered inroads. But if he supplied the seed, it was clearly Mrs. Aubin's business to see to the raising of the crop. Her attitude seemed indeed to throw his own reasonableness into distinct relief. So that they might have stood for thrift and improvidence in an allegory of the affections. It was not that Mrs. Aubin permitted herself to be a pensioner on his bounty. He knew as he had no wish to keep herself alive on the small change of sentiment. She simply fed on her own funded passion, and the luxuries it allowed her made him, even then, dimly aware that as he had the secret of an inexhaustible alchemy. Their relations remained thus negatively tender till she suddenly wrote him of her decision to go abroad to live. Her father had died, as he had no near ties in Hillbridge, and London offered more scope than New York to her expanding personality. She was already famous and her laurels were yet unharvested. For a moment the news roused Glenard to a jealous sense of lost opportunities. He wanted, at any rate, to reassert his power before she made the final effort of escape. They had not met for over a year, but of course he could not let her sail without seeing her. She came to New York the day before her departure, and they spent its last hours together. Glenard had planned no course of action, he simply meant to let himself drift. They both drifted, for a long time, down the languid current of reminiscence. She seemed to sit passive, letting him push his way back through the overgrown channels of the past. At length she reminded him that they must bring their explorations to an end. He rose to leave, and stood looking at her with the same uncertainty in his heart. He was tired of her already, he was always tired of her, yet he was not sure that he wanted her to go. "I may never see you again," he said, as though confidently appealing to her compassion. Her look enveloped him. "Andy, I shall see you always, always." "Why go then?" escaped him. "To be near you," she answered, and the words dismissed him like a closing door. The door was never to reopen. But through its narrow crack Glenard, as the years went on, became more and more conscious of an inextinguishable light directing its small ray toward the past which consumed so little of his own commemorative oil. The reproach was taken from this thought by Mrs. Aubin's gradual translation into terms of universality. In becoming a person that she so naturally ceased to be a person, that Glenard could almost look back to his explorations of her spirit, as on a visit to some famous shrine, immortalized, but in a sense desecrated, by popular veneration. Her letters, from London, continued to come with the same tender punctuality, but the altered conditions of her life, the vistas of new relationships disclosed by every phrase, made her communications as impersonal as a piece of journalism. It was as though the state, the world, indeed, had taken her off his hands, assuming the maintenance of a temperament that had long exhausted its slender store of reciprocity. In the retrospective light shed by the letters, he was blinded to their specific meaning. He was not a man who concerned himself with literature, and they had been to him, at first, simply the extension of her brilliant talk, later the dreaded vehicle of a tragic importunity. He knew, of course, that they were wonderful, that, unlike the authors who give their essence to the public, and keep only a dry rind for their friends, Mrs. Aubyn had stored of her rarest vintage for this hidden sacrament of tenderness. Sometimes, indeed, he had been oppressed, humiliated almost, by the multiplicity of her allusions, the wide scope of her interests, her persistence in forcing her superabundance of thought and emotion into the shallow receptacle of his sympathy. But he had never thought of the letters objectively, as the production of a distinguished woman, had never measured the literary significance of her oppressive prodigality. He was almost frightened now at the wealth in his hands. The obligation of her love had never weighed on him like this gift of her imagination. It was as though he had accepted from her something to which even a reciprocal tenderness could not have justified his claim. He sat a long time staring at the scattered pages on his desk, and in the sudden realization of what they meant he could almost fancy some alchemistic process changing them to gold as he stared. He had the sense of not being alone in the room, of the presence of another self observing from without the stirring of subconscious impulses that sent flushes of humiliation to his forehead. At length he stood up, and with the gesture of a man who wishes to give outward expression to his purpose to establish, as it were, a moral alibi, swept the letters into a heap, and carried them toward the grate. But it would have taken too long to burn all the packets. He turned back to the table and one by one, fitted the pages into their envelopes. Then he tied up the letters, and put them back into the locked drawer. 3. It was one of the laws of Glenard's intercourse with Miss Trent, that he always went to see her the day after he had resolved to give her up. There was a special charm about the moments thus snatched from the jaws of renunciation, and his sense of their significance was on this occasion so keen that he hardly noticed the added gravity of her welcome. His feeling for her had become so vital a part of him that her nearness had the quality of imperceptibly readjusting his point of view, so that the jumbled phenomena of experience fell at once into a rational perspective. In this redistribution of values, the somber retrospect of the previous evening shrank to a mere cloud on the edge of consciousness. Perhaps the only service an unloved woman can render the man she loves is to enhance and prolong his illusions about her rival. It was the fate of Margaret Aubyn's memory to serve as a foil to Miss Trent's presence, and never had the poor lady thrown her successor into more vivid relief. Miss Trent had the charm of still waters that are felt to be renewed by rapid currents. Her attention spread a tranquil surface to the demonstrations of others, and it was only in days of storm that one felt the pressure of the tides. This inscrutable composure was perhaps her chief grace in Glenard's eyes. Reserve, in some natures, implies merely the locking of empty rooms, or the dissimulation of awkward encumbrances. But Miss Trent's reticence was to Glenard like the closed door to the sanctuary, and his certainty of divining the hidden treasure made him content to remain outside in the happy expectancy of the neophyte. "You didn't come to the opera last night," she began, in the tone that seemed always rather to record a fact than to offer a reflection on it. He answered with a discouraged gesture. "That was the use? We couldn't have talked." "Not as well as here," she assented, adding, after a meditative pause, "as you didn't come, I talked to Aunt Virginia instead." "Ah," he returned, the fact being hardly striking enough to detach him from the contemplation of her hands, which had fallen, as was their wont, into an attitude full of plastic possibilities. One felt them to be hands that, moving only to some purpose, were capable of intervals of serene inaction. "We had a long talk," Miss Trent went on, and she waited again before adding, with the increased absence of stress that marked her graver communications, "Aunt Virginia wants me to go abroad with her." Glenard looked up with a start. "Broad? When? Now next month. To be gone 2 years. He permitted himself a movement of tender derision. Oh, she really? Well, I want you to go abroad with me for any number of years. Which offer do you accept? Only one of them seems to require immediate consideration, she returned, with a smile. Glenard looked at her again. You're not thinking of it? Her gaze dropped, and she unclasped her hands. Her movements were so rare that they might have been said to italicize her words. Aunt Virginia talked to me very seriously. It will be a great relief to Mother and the others to have me provided for in that way for 2 years. I must think of that, you know. She glanced down at her gown which, under a renovated surface, dated back to the first days of Glenard's wooing. Try not to cost much but I do. Good Lord. Glenard groaned. They sat silent till at length she gently took up the argument. As the eldest, you know, I'm bound to consider these things. Women are such a burden. Jim does what he can for Mother, but with his own children, to provide for it isn't very much. You see, we're all poor together. Your aunt isn't. She might help your mother. She does in her own way. Exactly, that's the rich relation all over. You may be miserable in any way you like, but if you're to be happy you've got to be so in her way and in her old gowns. I could be very happy in Aunt Virginia's old gowns, Miss Trent interposed. Abroad, you mean? I mean wherever I felt that I was helping. And my going abroad will help. Of course I see that. And I see your considerateness in putting its advantages negatively. Negatively? And dwelling simply on what the going will take you from, not on what it will bring you to. It means a lot to a woman, of course. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.